Good evening, Chicago. Welcome to the show.
I'm Bevan, with you, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics, as I am pretty much every Sunday night here on Chicago's Talk Leader 89 WLS. We got a great show for you tonight. We're going to talk about what else? The White House Correspondents' Dinner. If you haven't been on your phone today or watching any cable news, then you probably don't know that the White House Correspondents' Dinner took place last night. If you have been on your phone or watching the news, you know that there was a good deal of controversy last night centered around the comedian Michelle Wolf, who got kind of nasty toward Sarah Huckabee Sanders and a little bit raunchy in places. And I was in the room, so I saw it firsthand, and we are going to talk about that. We'll also talk about what Donald Trump was doing. He was obviously not there. He has not gone to this dinner. He chose to do what he did last year, which is go to a state that he won and hold a rally and talk about how awful the press is. Well, they're back in D.C. proving him right, usually. We'll also talk about all the other stuff that went on in Washington. I mean, it was a huge week in Washington. We had the state dinner and the visit by the French President Emmanuel Macron. We had Angela Merkel in town. We had big news on North Korea. We had some nomination fights going on. One successful for the president, Mike Pompeo. One unsuccessful, Ronny Jackson. But that may or may not be over. That has ignited a whole other feud between him and Senator John Tester from Montana. So we got a lot to get to. But we are going to start with Caitlin Huey Burns, who's national political reporter for Real Clear Politics. Caitlin, thank you for your time.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Caitlin, you were at the dinner last night along with me and a number of other folks from Real Clear Politics and our guests. And so Michelle Wolf came on, and this is the part in particular that is generating the most interest and perhaps outrage. This is Michelle Wolf, and she's standing at the podium. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is sitting two seats to her left, not even 6 feet away, and this is what she said. Listen.
We are graced with Sarah's presence. I have to say, I'm a little starstruck. I love you as Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale. Mike Pence, if you haven't seen it, you would love it. Every time Sarah steps up to the podium, I get excited because I'm not really sure what we're going to get. You know, a press briefing, a bunch of lies, or divided into softball teams. It's shirts and skins, and this time don't be such a little bitch, Jim Acosta. And I'm never really sure what to call Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You know, is it Sarah Sanders? Is it Sarah Huckabee Sanders? Is it Cousin Huckabee? Is it Auntie Huckabee Sanders? Like, what's Uncle Tom but for white women who disappoint other white women? Oh, I know, Aunt Coulter. I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
So, Caitlin, your reaction when you heard that last night and just hearing it again?
Yeah, I know. Hearing it again, it's even more jarring. I think all of us in that room were uncomfortable at that. You don't really even want to call it a joke because it was kind of beyond the pale, I think, for an event like this. I mean, look, we've been to the Correspondents' Dinner a number of times. And for the public, I think it's important for the public to know that this dinner was originally for, the White House Correspondents' Association, and it gives scholarships to young college kids who want to pursue careers in journalism. It's a night to kind of honor the White House press corps and journalism and celebrate it. And there were other speeches kind of to that tune. And this just really undermined whatever goodwill was intended by those other speeches. And so it was just seen as unnecessary and, you know, really just kind of, I think, presented the president with a clear picture for him to show supporters of his, saying, look, the media was at this event in which this comedian just lambasted the Trump administration and those who voted for him, essentially. So I think it plays well into Trump's hands in a way, but I think you had a lot of uncomfortable journalists there last night.
Yeah, you know, I've been to this dinner now for more than a decade, and look, it is a tough gig for comedians. Plenty of comedians,
yeah.
Even famous ones, have you know, failed miserably at this job. It is not easy, but it does seem it is continues to get more and more mean-spirited. And it verges more toward a roast when it's not actually designed to be a roast. You're not up there trying to say the meanest, you know, most outrageous things you can about everybody in the room. But that's how it often comes off. And the stuff about Sarah Sanders in particular, for me, was just way beyond the pale. I mean, in fact, I think everybody, you saw a lot of journalists on Twitter reacting to and saying it was uncalled for, et cetera, et cetera. But the rest of her routine, too, Caitlin, was shockingly, raunchy and in some places mm-hmm. vulgar. And which, again, was some people have used some language from time to time. But this was a whole nother level, which, again, surprised me and I thought didn't really go over well. In terms of what the night was supposed to be about.
Yeah, I agree. And, there is a lot of talk today about whether the dinner should be restructured in some way and not have a comedian at this dinner and just make it solely about, you know, awards for journalists and for scholarships. I think, we have been over the past several years, but I think us in the Trump administration is a little bit different, of course, because for the past 2 years, the president has not gone when the president traditionally does go to these things. This is an administration that, is in constant combat with the press and in a way that fuels a lot of feelings on both sides of the aisle. So I think this relationship between the administration and the press that covers it is a little bit different in terms of that. And so, you know, if you are Donald Trump, I think you can take that comedian and tell your supporters that, you know, this is an elitist group that is going after me and therefore they're going after you. And it can be somewhat of a rallying cry, as we saw during the campaign. And I think even more so now.
Yeah, I do wonder if this will lead to Brett Baer, for example, was one of the ones who called for change. Some other folks have on Twitter have suggested that they restructure the dinner because it does feel, mm-hmm. especially in the last couple of years, like it's gone off the rails. And, I know to the extent the public watches this at all, I mean, I don't think a lot of people are watching it on C-SPAN, right? They get clips the next morning
and they
watch perhaps the Sunday shows, or they're watching cable news and that's how they're getting their information about what comes out. And it always seems to be the most offensive stuff, which I guess makes sense. But at the same time, it just doesn't augur well. I think the public looks at this dinner and thinks a lot of them look at it and think that it's exactly what Trump says. It's even some journalists are. I mean, Carl Cannon, our Washington bureau chief, who couldn't make it this year because he was sick. But I mean, I think he is often uncomfortable sometimes of how the public views this dinner. That it's, you know, the elites of Washington and the reporters sort of yucking it up at the mm-hmm. president's expense or the public's expense, and while they're dining on rubber chicken and drinking Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And there's also a feeling, and especially in this administration, because President Trump does go after the media so much because it's, you know, a big part of his appeal to a, you know, broad base of support, I think. This does play right into his hands, really. And I think there's also a feeling, at least among journalists who want to cover this administration and politics fairly, is that while the president and some of his supporters go after the press and don't like the press, that doesn't give, of course, the license for the media to go to that level as well. And now, while, of course, this is a comedian, this is not a journalist, I think the fact that she was invited to speak to a group of journalists by journalists, you know, just the optics of it, I think just don't look good for anyone.
You know, Caitlin, you know,
comedians, sure.
I'm sorry, but just you make an interesting point, because as you look at Twitter and you look at some of the reaction, folks on the left, folks, Donald Trump critics, one of their points is, hey, listen, you know, Trump's been vulgar the entire time. He makes fun of people. He insults people. He calls them names.
Right.
And suddenly, you know, this woman, this comedian comes on and throws a few insults at Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And like, what'd they expect? Like, this is what Trump is. He's just, you know, getting what he gives, that kind of thing. You know, what's your response to that criticism? I find that to be just to the point that you just made, a little bit weak in terms of that just doesn't give people license to do whatever. And by the way, she works for the president, but she's not the president. I mean, she is she was there representing the administration, but she didn't get a chance to defend herself in any way. She just had to kind of sit there and take it, or she could have walked out, which probably would have made things worse.
Right, exactly. She did stay the whole time. And, you know, those of us who know Sarah and work with Sarah, you know, these jokes were unfair. And it is one thing to go after Trump and another to go after her, although she is a public figure in a way that press secretaries have not been in the past by virtue of just this intense interest in this administration. You know, I do see the argument that some people have been making of, you know, Trump has made fun of a lot of people and this should not be a surprise. And, you know, there are comedians every night on television poking fun at the president and kind of dishing it right back to him. But that's a very different kind of setting, I would say. And comedians are comedians. Again, you know, Michelle Wolf is not a journalist, but the idea of a comedian at an event to celebrate journalism, and especially after conversations about how journalism is serving a higher purpose and trying to stay above the fray, just the optics of this just did not do justice to some of the other things that were talked about that evening.
Yeah. We're speaking with Caitlin Huey Burns, national political reporter for Brooklyn Politics. Going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about what Donald Trump was doing while all of this is going on and what it potentially means. So stick around. We're going to be right back after these words.
Here's Steve, Dog, and Brendan. Weekdays 2 until 6 p.m. on WLS AM 890.
And we're back. I'm joined on the phone by Caitlin Huey Burns, our national political reporter for Real Clear Politics. I'm Tom Bevan, co-founder of RCP. So, Caitlin, we were talking about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Of course, Trump, for the second consecutive year, did not attend. He was off rallying the troops in Michigan. And by all accounts, I think they had something like 35,000 people there, people who couldn't get in. I mean, it seemed like another huge rally for Donald Trump, who you know, was sort of classically himself last night, you know, riling people up and riffing about all sorts of different subjects.
That's right. I mean, it was certainly a way for him to offer some counter programming. And from a purely political standpoint, I think it was a pretty smart idea for him to do that, because he can be in a place like Michigan, which he won, and say, look, I am out here talking to you. I'm not, you know, hobnobbing with the media elites, as he calls them. And that has a certain appeal among his core base of support, certainly the Republican Party at large, and people who kind of, you know, see Washington as kind of a swamp of sorts. So I think it was, you know, by, again, a purely political standpoint, a good way for him to show that contrast.
So, Caitlin, one of the interesting notes about all of this is that this past week was Bring Your Children to Work Day at the White House, right? And you were there covering this. Tell the story that you told me about how Trump handled and how the White House handled the kids of the journalists, which Trump, you know, notoriously does battle with on a daily basis. Tell our listeners a little bit about what that looked like at the White House.
Yeah, it was quite a funny day. I was on pool duty that day, which means that you have to kind of be the eyes and ears at the White House. And the White House did a nice job of having events for the children of White House staffers and also for the children of the White House Press Corps. So, you know, they had a news conference with Sarah Sanders in which the kids got to ask questions of her. They ranged everything from asking what the president's favorite candy was to why he fired James Comey. So there was, you know, perhaps some of the parents prepped some questions themselves.
Right.
Then the president invited the kids into the Rose Garden, which, as you know, is a beautiful setting in the White House, and it was a beautiful day. And the pool, of course, was there, and he was signing placards and different things the kids were handing him, and saying things like, you know, you're so well-behaved. Your parents are never this well-behaved. They must not want to be embarrassed in front of you. And he was definitely riffing on that. One of our colleagues had a daughter in the crowd too, and Trump told her that he likes his father 80% of the time. So that was a funny little joke as well. He also, you know, asked the kids if they wanted to go into the Oval Office, and he said, "Do you want to go to the Oval Office?" And they screamed, "Yes!" And he said, "Do you want your parents to come?" And they screamed, "No!" Luckily, they invited us all in, and it was a nice day for the kids. It would be very cool, I think, as a child to see the Oval Office. Of course, they got to sit near the Resolute desk and take their picture with the president. So, no matter what your political affiliation is, I think it is a very cool thing to see the White House in that kind of way.
And it's just such an interesting juxtaposition to the sort of daily battle that goes on. I do think, more broadly speaking, though, Caitlin, and again, you have been, you know, covering Washington for a number of years now, and I keep asking people this question that I'm going to ask you right now, which is, and it's hard to know the answer, but is the deteriorating, you know, because Obama certainly had his issues with the press, and while he, mm-hmm. you know, Trump gets called the authoritarian, Obama was actually the one who was, you know, putting them in prison and tapping their phones and doing, you know, all sorts of things like that. But is the trust now between the administration and the press corps, is the animosity, has it passed the tipping point where there's no reconciling it? There's no going back. It's certainly, you know, within the Trump, whether Trump's president for two more years or five more years, is there any sign of a detente, or is it just going to continue to be the sort of daily battle that it is and perhaps get even nastier as we move forward?
Well, what I think people have to understand is how much this president actually really loves the media. He loves media attention, and he knows it really well, having been, you know, a producer of a reality TV show, of course, The Apprentice. And, you know, he knows how to work certain angles to get attention on certain things. And he follows it, I think, more closely than any president in memory. I mean, he actively watches these shows and interviews, can, you know, pick out people from a crowd and know he knows all the journalists. And he often calls people from outlets that he denigrates often. Maggie Haberman is a good example, or others from the Washington Post or Wall Street Journal. He gives interviews. So I think we have to understand how much the president, you know, likes the media to an extent, and also uses it as kind of his whole MO, in a way to kind of, you know, the media to him and his supporters. And it has been for a long time to conservative Republicans that the media just doesn't have the same grasp on the rest of the country and certain realities, they say. And so it's been a foil for him, I think, more so than it has been for other presidents. So I think, you know, I'm not sure what will happen, but if the past couple of years are any indication, it will continue the way it is. And I'd also note, too, that Michelle Wolf, the comedian we were speaking with about in the earlier segment, she had a lot of things to say about the administration, but she had a lot of things to say about the media as well. And she made, I think, a pretty prescient point, which was, you know, or at least brought it up, which is the media is kind of obsessed with Trump and has been certainly profiting from covering him in this administration. And you can argue to that. You can argue that and dispute it to varying degrees. But I think it was a point that it will be talked about that point, I think, will be talked about for a while.
All right. We've got to leave it there. Caitlin Healy-Burns, national political reporter for Real Clear Politics. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll have A.B. Stoddard, one of our associate editors at Real Clear Politics, on to talk about all the other stuff that happened this week, and there was a lot. So stick around. We'll be right back after these words. I am Tom Bevin, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics, joined now on the phone by A.B. Stoddard, who's one of our associate editors, writes a weekly column for us. She's also the host of a radio show of her own called No Labels Radio on Sirius XM Radio, Channel 124. A.B., thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you back. Okay, so let's talk about what went on in Washington this week outside of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, because as I was running through the list earlier, there was a lot that happened.
Yeah.
But first, let's start with the Trump administration. Trump, they had one victory in getting Mike Pompeo confirmed as Secretary of State. That's official now. Not without a little bit of drama in the committee trying to move that recommendation forward. But then we had this blow up over Ronnie Jackson to be the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, which was really pretty dramatic the way that this all went down. And you had these allegations against him that he was handing out, prescriptions. I mean, he was handing out pills, that he was drunk on the job, that he had wrecked a car, that he had done all these horrible things. Trump was famously at one of the press conferences this week, was asked about Ronnie Jackson, and he was kind of like, look, I wouldn't do it. There's no reason for him to put himself through this, basically. But I support him if he wants to do it. He said he came out and said he was going to, initially said he was going to fight this, that it was all lies. The White House released a bunch of reports from the Obama administration talking about what a great guy he was, how he should be promoted above, his peers because he was so well regarded. And then he turned out and pulled his nomination. But the more we find out, AB, the more it looks like he may have been, some people have called it character assassination, that he was perhaps slimed and run out of town in a very, partisan and unethical way. What do we know about this? I mean, Trump has really gotten after Senator John Tester in particular about the way that he conducted himself. He said last night at his rally that he knows some things that could perhaps end John Tester's career if he were to let them out, which I thought was an interesting bit of a threat from the president of the United States. But what do we know about this? How much of this was this a hit job? Was this dirty politics?
I think it was mishandled, Tom. I think that a couple things. First of all, I think the president's threat against John Tester is just, one more time, just completely beneath the office. And just outrageous. But it's clear that Senator Tester mishandled these allegations by sort of discussing them in a public forum. The allegations are credible enough from more than 20 people, I believe 23 people came to the senators. Senator Isaacson, who's the Veterans Affairs Committee chairman who worked closely with John Tester, put out a statement over the weekend saying he has no problem with what John Tester did. He brought these allegations to the White House, Tom, weeks ago. The Washington Post reported that last week, and the White House staff remained unconcerned and did not respond to the senators who were seeking information about these allegations. They are credible allegations that were backed up by reporting from the New York Times. You can check Jonathan Wiseman's Twitter over the weekend. He said that these are active and retired military who cannot go on a record, but brought their concerns to the media, in addition to bringing them unsolicited to the senators working on this nomination in the Veterans Affairs Committee. I'm not saying that they're all true, but they have been credible allegations that have raised concern on both sides of the aisle. And Senator Isaacson's statement goes very far in telling us whether or not John Tester went out on a wild campaign to malign Ronny Jackson, or whether or not there's enough credence to these. Ronny Jackson, Dr. Jackson, has obviously earned an incredible amount of goodwill from several teams surrounding several presidents. He is beloved. And there is a very much a narrative here of someone who earned the trust of first families and presidents who, under the Obama administration, clearly were willing to look the other way. The office, the medical office within the West Wing, is also kind of a protected bubble. And just because there isn't Secret Service records of events happening doesn't mean that the events didn't actually happen. This is a protected status, this sort of bubble that office functions in and that physician, first physician, functions in. And I believe we're going to be hearing more about this because John Tester is not someone who comes out regularly. In the world of veterans affairs issues, it just goes after some cheap politicking. So while he probably mishandled it, it doesn't mean the allegations are untrue. President seeing an opportunity to go after a Democrat in a state Trump won is trying to make it into a campaign issue and trying to ask that John Tester resign, or at least the voters of Montana reject him. I think because, like I mentioned, what Senator Isaacson said, we're going to be hearing more defense of just Senator John Tester from his Republican colleagues. And I think there's going to be more reporting on these allegations in the days and weeks to come.
I certainly hope there is, because it is, to me, and you may be right about this, but it does seem, it would seem to me to be, given what we know about Ronny Jackson, and as you mentioned, the glowing reports that he got, I mean, it's almost like this Jekyll and Hyde situation. How could a guy be so beloved and so well respected, and you know, he's promoted and continued to be promoted, and at the same time be doing all these horrible things? That is it. That would be shocking to me if both of those things were true. And it seems like the thing about it too, AB, I think that bothers me a little bit, is that it's almost, you get this situation where the burden of proof lies in not in the accusations, the accusers, the anonymous source, but on the accused.
On the victim. I agree. Yeah,
and
I
that
agree.
That kind of bothers me. And of course, the way that it was handled, you're probably right, it was mishandled. But you know, this guy, these accusations should be vetted in in a committee hearing, maybe even a closed hearing. And it just seems like
I think
it was.
They have, I, in defense of Senator Tester and Senator Isaacson, I think they have been vetted in a bipartisan way behind closed doors for weeks before they even made their way into the media reports. But like I said, they're going to have to come up and say more. Senator Isaacson is likely going to have to come up and come out and say more. I know he likes to do things quietly, but it was his statement in defense of John Tester over the weekend, and the fact that that a reporter like Jonathan Wiseman is saying these are coming from military people who are not allowed to speak out on the record. I just think means it's a story that hasn't been told in its entirety yet.
Well, let's hope we learn more about it. And it did seem also, again, this is probably the sequencing of events, that, you know, Democrats, the Mike Pompeo nomination, right, which he had just been confirmed as CIA director, you know, what, 15 months ago, and yet you had all these Democrats, the ones that voted for him 14 months ago, suddenly were opposed to him. As if they were, you know, looking for a scalp, looking to stick it to the Trump administration. And when they weren't able to get Pompeo, they sort of immediately turned their sights on Ronny Jackson. That's, whether that's true or not, that's what it looked like based on the way that this stuff went down. But Pompeo did get through, but not without a couple of, you know, the flipping of Rand Paul, and also a fairly, you know, interesting move by Senator Chris Coons, where he allowed the nomination to move forward, recommended out of the Foreign Relations Committee, which was, you know, I actually was at a party on Tuesday night, the night after that happened, and Chris Coons was there, and he was telling the story about it, and he said, AB, that he just did the sort of minimally decent thing, but the amount of praise that he received was so disproportionate, because even small acts of kindness in Washington now, they just never happen. And when they do happen, they're almost shocking in the fact that someone would. And, you know, he said, look, Johnny Isaacson was giving a eulogy for one of his friends in Georgia and couldn't get back in time. And he said, you know, I just did this. It didn't change the outcome at all. It was just sort of an act of kindness. And he was sort of flabbergasted that it got as much attention as it did. I guess that's the way it is in Washington these days.
Yeah, I really respect Senator Coons for what he did. And I actually heard him explain as well that Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican, a year or so ago, had afforded him the same courtesy when his dad was sick, Senator Coons. And these things do happen more frequently than we learn, which gives me, you know, it heartens me. I wish the public knew how frequently they actually do happen. But what's interesting is, in this polarized environment, the senators keep it, keep their courteous behavior more private than we can really understand. They keep up a partisan face, even though I know, and you know, that they meet for Bible study, they weep together, they help each other when their families are struggling. So, you know, it was the right thing to do. And you and I talked about the Mike Pompeo nomination last week. I mean, I think that the Democrats were really being foolhardy to, I knew enough of them in the end would support him, because I knew that they wanted him to get through, because they knew that he was able and qualified for the job. And they were, you know, they feared what the next choice might be out of President Trump for that very critical position. But yeah, they played a political game with it as well. It's very easy to say, I supported Mike Pompeo as CIA director because he's obviously, you know, has impeccable credentials for that job, where he would not speak for our country overseas, not be the face of our diplomatic efforts overseas. I think he's, you know, not as well suited for this position. I'm upset about these following things he said, but I'm still going, you know, to vote to confirm him. But they lodged protest votes, and I just think it was the wrong nomination to oppose. But as I predicted, a few of them stepped forward because they wanted him to be the next Secretary of State.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we get back, AB, we got to cover the other happenings in Washington, the bromance with between Trump and Macron, and a little bit frostier relations between Trump and Angela Merkel, both of whom who were in Washington this past week. Stick around. We're going to take a quick break. Be right back. We are back. Tom Bevan with you, co-founder, publisher of Real Clear Politics. I've got A.B. Stoddard on the phone. She's one of our associate editors. Writes a weekly column for us. You will see her byline on RCP. She's also host of No Labels Radio on SiriusXM, POTUS Channel 124. We're talking about Washington, what went down this week. A.B., the Macron trip was very interesting in that you had this real bromance between Trump and Macron. He was, you know, they could barely keep their hands off each other. They were, you know, shaking hands and you know, air kissing and doing all sorts of stuff, and just had this great, you know, rapport through the state dinner. And then Macron goes to Congress and addresses Congress and really offers a very sort of critical view of some of Trump's policies and worldviews in terms of, you know, nationalism and, you know, those kinds of things, which I thought was pretty interesting. What did you make of that? Was that, was Macron just being very Machiavellian in the way that he handled his trip, knowing that he would butter up Trump on the front end and sort of kick him in the shins on the way out the door?
Well, Macron is very, very shrewd, very smart, and he clearly had been working for months to try to persuade President Trump from exiting the Iran deal, and came to town with the snuggles and the long handshakes, hand holding, and air kissing, and all this to convince him to do that new foundation, that amendment to the Iran deal that he spoke at length about in the presser. that would provide President Trump a way to recertify the Iran deal and not break it apart by, you know, trying to enhance accountability for the regime and to deal with ICBM testing and certain things, Iran's aggression in the region, and addressing the complaints that President Trump has. He was very smooth about this. They obviously spoke privately about it. In the morning, Trump roared like a lion. By the afternoon, he was saying, maybe I'll listen to this new proposal. It was clear that Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, was going to sweep into town a few days later and reinforce Macron's, you know, insistence that this could be a new way out, a sort of a third way. It's obviously there's no enforcement mechanism for it, and it's not binding. But it was sort of a way that, you know, that these people who disagree, these leaders who disagree with Trump, could get him away from the cliff of blowing up this deal. It was clear after President Macron addressed the Congress, Tom, that he felt that he had failed to convince him. He said, I think the president is going to withdraw. He met with about 40 reporters afterwards and said, I think he's going to withdraw. And he basically said withdrawing is insane, and said that we can't make a deal with the North Koreans on nuclear disarmament if we pull out of previous treaties and deals. So Macron wanted to put his foot down and talk about the dangers of misinformation and nationalism and the benefits of multilateralism and all the disagreements and criticisms of Trumpism on his way out, and make sure when he went home to face the French press, who was very concerned that he had been belittled by the president taking his dandruff off his shoulder, that he had stood his ground as well. It's a tough balancing act.
It is a tough, it has to be a tough needle to thread. Real quickly, what about Angela Merkel and her visit? She also wanted to convince the president on Iran. She also appears to have failed. Any other things that you noticed during her visit and the press conference between the two of them?
I just want to say that I did notice that they don't have the relationship that President Trump does with President Macron, but I do think that he was more solicitous of her, calling her Angela, not at their presser, but their meeting in the Oval beforehand. He kept thanking her, saying she had a great reelection victory, and he was much more warm with her than he has been in the past, and that's not nothing. So I thought that they did their best to get through, you know, what is a huge disagreement on the Iran deal and try to put a good face on it. She talked about how the tax cuts had made the U.S. a more attractive place to invest in, and they got through it. I thought it was better than it's been in the past, and an improvement is a good thing.
The biggest news this week, AB, on the foreign policy front was this remarkable summit between North and South Korea, where you had Kim Jong-un sort of walking across the border. They, you know, planted a tree together and pledged that this was going to be sort of a new era in North Korea. They agreed to the goal of the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, but without a lot of detail behind it. But nevertheless, a move in the right direction. And this seems to also have, you know, Trump praised the summit. And what do you make of, and this sort of is sort of teeing up his meeting, although I read a lot of analysis where pieces that were in the press were kind of like, okay, you know, the stakes have just gone up for Trump. He's got to close the deal, which I thought was a little bit disingenuous. You know, suddenly turning and putting all the pressure on Trump to get a deal done. He said earlier this week, they're not, you know, America's not going to get played like it has in the past. If it's not, you know, if we don't like what's going on, we're going to walk away from the table. What do you make of the revelations this week out of Korea?
Right. Well, Kim Jong-un, the leader in North Korea, knows that President Moon, the new leader of South Korea, came into office as president announcing that he wanted to immediately warm relations and meet with the North Korean leader. And he had a welcome host, you know, a receptive adversary in President Moon, someone that he could warm up. So he has, after much threats. The Japanese are very skeptical about this. They're very concerned. I believe that the U.S. government is skeptical, and I heard very firm comments out of Mike Pompeo about how they are not going to let up on the pressure campaign. President Trump has made it clear, Tom, he'll walk away from the table if it's not enough. But we have never seen the North Korean leader give any reason to back off a full commitment to a full nuclear arsenal. It's what they've put everything into developing. And there's always a scenario he gets to the table and says, thank you for putting me on the world stage at the same level as you. I can talk to you about a freeze, but I'm not going to totally dismantle. I've taken all this time and I've brought my program to full development and ha ha ha. So we really don't know what we're getting into. But the South Korean president and President Trump and everyone who agreed, all the nations who came to the table at the UN on those sanctions, all deserve credit to getting us to where we are now, which is better than war. I think we just all hope that the Trump administration is proceeding with full preparation for every possible scenario for this summit, and that they'll be willing to cancel it if they don't believe that Kim Jong-un is living up to the agreement or negotiating in good faith. Of course, it's high risk, but I think it looks like a risk worth taking that they look prepared to take.
Yeah, Trump raised eyebrows this week when he said that Kim Jong-un had been operating in a sort of honorable way in the process. I mean, people were, took that comment and sort of, I think, blew it out of context a little bit. But nevertheless, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. All right, AB, we got to leave it there. Thanks for your time tonight. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Okay. One programming note before I get out of here. I wanted to let you all know on June 5th at 6 p.m. in Chicago downtown, I am hosting a Lincoln Forum event. I will be interviewing Brett Baer of Fox News Channel about his new book. It's called 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire. Brett had a best-selling book with 3 Days in January. This is the sort of second edition. It's gotten great reviews. I'm halfway through it. I can tell you it's going to be great, and I'm looking forward to that. You can get tickets to this event at lincolnforum.org/events. Again, June 5th at 6 p.m. I look forward to seeing you all there. And until next Sunday night, I'm Tom Bevin, co-founder of Real Clear Politics. Everybody have a great week.